You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Infinite Success with Elena Scher. During the next hour, you will gain valuable, life-changing information to rewire your mind from your everyday life into an extraordinary new way of living. Join Elena as she shares universal principles that will create the life you have been dreaming of.
Well, good morning and welcome to Law of Attraction Radio and Infinite Success with myself, Elena Scher. With me today, I am so honored to have Carol Howe. She has been coined as the mother of spirituality. She is a best-selling author, a spiritual coach, and she has been a 40-plus year teacher of A Course in Miracles. Carol's powerful message of love and healing has reached over 5 million people, and we keep on adding to that. Welcome so much, Carol. I am so, so happy to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you. I love being here. It's endlessly fascinating to talk about.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I want to talk about first A Course in Miracles. What is A Course in Miracles, and how did you get involved?
Well, I got involved because I had quite a long history of searching for answers from the time I was a little girl. And it was kind of always in the background of growing up and going to college and having a couple of jobs and so on and so forth. But my real interest was, what's missing? What's real? What makes life work, so to speak? So we had a house guest back 44 years ago, back in 1977. And he sent us a subscription to New Realities magazine as a little house gift. And the first edition that came to us had the very first article about the course that was ever published. And wow. It was several pages long, and it included a copy of the introduction to the text. And I read that, and I was just hit to the core of my being. This is for me. And I ordered it. And I can remember when the package was delivered, you couldn't buy it in bookstores then. It was in its plain brown wrapper. And as I held it, I thought, finally, after decades, my search is over. I knew that with all kinds of inner awareness before I'd even opened the first page. And I was right. It was the end of the search. It just rearranged. It took everything I knew. So by that time, I was pretty metaphysically aware, so to speak. I had read a lot and so on and so forth. I happily grew up in a metaphysically friendly family. So I had access to alternative ideas about things from early on, for which I am incredibly grateful. So that's how the course just landed in my life.
Oh, wonderful. It's, you know, and it's a lot of us really, because we operate from a 3D world. Dr. Joe Dispenza always says, I don't know if you're familiar with him or not.
Oh, I am.
I think he's wonderful. And he always talks about, you know, we're dealing from a place of matter instead of from a place of space, which is usually the way a lot of people talk about metaphysical. Mm-hmm. And when we're taking out of, and I always kind of like to call it as the ego's way of dealing with things, which is matter, the 3D consciousness. And then when you take it to metaphysical is when you take it into the realm of spirituality that encompasses all.
Absolutely.
So one of the workshops that I attended for you, it was See How Life Works. And I thought that was very fascinating because it really broke down the Course in Miracles and how it really pertains to your everyday living. I mean, a lot of times, you know, we read these self-help books and then we kind of wonder why our lives aren't changing.
Exactly. What do I do now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, what do I do now? How do I make this work? And you were actually very good friends. You were one of the original students of A Course in Miracles. And you were a very good friend of Bill Fetford's. And he was one of the, you know, he was the original, him and Helen were the scribes to it. They were the ones who were taking down the information from this channeling of Jesus.
Yes, absolutely. They were the co-scribes. And it was a long, arduous 11-year process from the time Helen got her first evening message that said, because she had been having some kind of waking dreams and, you know, what's going on here? And she heard an inner voice, that's the way it registered for her, that said, please take notes. This is A Course in Miracles. And she freaked out, because freaking out was what she did on a regular basis over things. And she called Bill and she said, I just got this message that says, please take notes. This is A Course in Miracles. What shall I do? And he said, take notes, but don't read it. Do not read it. Don't look at it. You bring it in the morning. We'll close the door. We'll read it together. Because he knew she had the possibility of being kind of hysterical about things. And said, and if it's crazy, if it's dumb, if it doesn't make any sense, we'll throw it in the wastebasket and nobody will ever know. Well, of course, when they both read this beautiful and concise and brilliant introduction to the course, they knew, oh my, this is not just some weird something or another. So that was the way it all began.
And their tumultuous relationship is really what they were both looking for another way. And that's what brought this on in the beginning.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like, as the Course says, someplace your tolerance for pain may be high, but it is not without limit. You know, at some point it's like, oh, there's got to be a better way. And when they both agreed, and Bill was very surprised that she agreed that she would be part of a, like, what could possibly be a better way? But anyway, they were the perfect people to do it. And it's turned out, as far as it's a restatement of ancient wisdom. This isn't like a brand new thing that's just appeared on the planet. But it's the same fundamental outlook on life and way of describing life that goes back at least 5,000 years in the Eastern world. So, and as far as I'm concerned, only I'm not an authority. I'm an authority on the course, but not on the whole broad spectrum of writings. But people who are do believe that this is the most important work, at least in the last 2,000 years, because of its ability to change the quality of people's lives if they, it's not so much if they understand it intellectually, if they will put the principles into practice. And if you were going to do a kind of an overview of like what that big thick book and all that workbook and everything that does, it's like, what is that about? If you were to reduce it down to like two or three sentences, you would say, we all carry guilt, a lot of which we are not aware of.
Absolutely.
And the guilt is always a request for punishment. And it will, as guilt is part of our inner thought process, even though it may be buried to us, and because our outer world, that means every circumstance down to, you know, the condition of the weeds in your yard to it, something that's very cosmic that's in our lives, whatever is there is, as the Course says, a self-portrait of the ego. In other words, a self, your world is showing you what you believe and think and so on and so forth. In other words, and if I have an unsatisfactory world out here where I'm lacking money or health or relationships, of course, are the big three, but where things are not right or I feel mistreated or I'm ill or whatever it might be, it always has an internal core, so to speak. It has an invisible internal, and where things do not go right, as far as we're concerned, it's always because of guilt, because guilt always is about punishment, and you can't say, hey, listen, universe, let's not do this. It's like, so the whole purpose of the course is to help us become aware of all of this. And it's done primarily through relationships.
So, I love what you said too. There was one podcast that I was listening to that you had done, and when you said this so beautifully, you said you can't be aware of your subconscious belief system, but you can be aware of what this person is doing out here, which brings all of that to the surface.
Yes, because it is a mirror of it. In other words,
yes.
It's like that's because my conscious mind has only so much in it. My unconscious mind has a great deal more. And that's where so much guilt resides, stuff we're not even aware of. Well, whether we're aware of it or not, it's still doing its damage, so to speak. It's still compromising our lives, which is why we must get to the bottom of it and relationships to the rescue, so to speak, because along comes a somebody. It could be a family member, a neighbor, a colleague, or whoever. There are never any accidents about who we meet. And if I've got a somebody here that I don't like for whatever reason, the sooner I get, this person is arriving as, you can call it a messenger, you can call it a trigger, you can call it whatever you want to call it. But whatever that, and if it's a person, I'm talking about the people that we, for whatever reason, don't like. I mean, we're happy mm-hmm. to see the people that we are comfortable around. But as somebody who has been, quote, annoying, that person is such a match to something that I hold against myself that I possibly don't even know about. In other words, down here in my unconscious mind, but this triggers this. And if I could see that this is a valuable encounter rather than a terrible encounter that shouldn't be happening. In other words, this is a messenger sent to help me discover what I am holding on to that I have to release if I'm going to have any decent life whatsoever. And the more guilt I release, the better my feeling, you know, my inner state, mm-hmm. as well as the circumstances of my life automatically change. I don't have to go out there and say, listen, world, I've changed my mind. So now it's on you. It's all automatic. And there's no compromising with this. We can't go, could there be a plan B rather than having to live along with my mother-in-law? It's like, no, there is not a plan B. You have to become aware of what you are holding against yourself mm-hmm. and let it go.
And one of the lessons in there, which is my favorite lesson, I'm actually a hypnotherapist as well. And I find that the course with hypnotherapy and also law of attraction are so beautiful together. It's like poetry in motion. One of my favorite lessons, and this is actually how I wound up finding my husband, who I've been married to for about 15 years. And it's lesson six, you're never upset for the reason that you think. We tend to think that in my 30s, in my dating world, and I was, you know, every SOB that was out there, they were all showing me in one form or another something that I was holding in my belief system,
yes.
which was an idea that I took on at the age of 7 when I saw my dad leave. And that was, you know, no one wants to be with me.
Exactly.
And yeah. And as soon as that was faced and embraced and looked at and healed and looked at with the eyes of a much higher awareness, which we'll definitely talk about later on in the interview, 3 months later, my husband came along. We've been very happily married for, you know, some people, 15 years isn't a lot. For me, it's my longest relationship ever. So, yeah. And so, but a lot of times, you know, we tend to look at those people out there and it's, oh God, if they weren't this and if they weren't that and da, da, da. But we don't tend to look at life as a mirror. That was one of the things that Bill Thetford had talked about. He said that when he started to really read the course, He said that he said it literally turned his world upside down. He said it was unlike anything. It was like so opposite of anything that he had ever been taught in life. And that's so true, really, for all of us. We've never been taught any of this. We've never even been taught the idea of even free will. We're just taking our ego's word for everything, hook, line, and sinker.
Yes, and we have to know where this sense of personal self comes from. Because if you stand back and make a metaphysical statement, you can say, we all choose to come into this experience. And we choose to come into it because this is just a schoolroom. This is an opportunity for us to let go of yet more baggage, so to speak. So we're the producer directors from instant one. But now once I get myself born, and then I kind of talk about it from a time and space point of view, until I'm about 3 years old, my left brain is present but not functioning. In other words, I do not know myself as a person when I'm a baby and a toddler and a little tiny person. All I know is I'm the experience I'm having. And I only have my right brain to work with. Now, my right brain is intuitive, instinctive. It's feeling. There's no verbal component to it. Because guess what? The young of all species, whether you're a human or whether you're a fly, your job as the young is to survive. And so as I'm experiencing my environment, which is made up of the energy fields of parents and the culture I'm born into and the religion I'm born into and the social status I'm born, all of that is a big mix here. And I'm learning intuitively, oh, this is safe to go toward. Oh, this is not safe to go toward. In other words, I'm not doing this in any way intellectually because I don't have the horsepower yet to do that. I don't have that part of my brain. But this early 3 years experience becomes you can call it the blueprint, you can call it the mulch you're planting your plant in or whatever, but I literally construct a story of me. In other words, this our ego sense of separate self is an artificial construct, and it starts being built and grows out of that early experience. Now, I have no way at that early age to properly identify what's going on. In other words, it's like there's no way I can do that. So I'm automatically, as I build this story of me, you can call it the ego, you can call it the personal self. The main thing is it is an artificial construct. It is a story. And the story is going to get some of its main components from that early time that I have no direct ability to recall. And it ends up with ire incorporating in this self that I'm inventing, that there's some things that are the matter with me. You know, of all of the thousands of people I've done counseling with, there are probably about 8 words of all the words in the world, and like a feeling of the way they assess themselves, which is unworthy or undeserving, or they can't do things right, or they're not important, or they're uninteresting, or people don't care about them, or and it might not be every single word, and in this mulch, but you see, we incorrectly connected the dots when we were little, and so we grow up, and since we've never known anything else, it wouldn't occur to us to say, oh, these are just some beliefs I picked up along the way. We think this is the truth about us.
We think it's our identity. And the thing is, too, what's very interesting, what you just said, is that the right brain that's intuitive, it's connected, And then we, and left brain's not fully developed. And at three is when that left brain starts to develop. Am I right? And that left brain is that part of our mind that's taking on the identity of basically everything that we're seeing and we're interpreting. And the hypnotic terms, we're basically in deep theta, you know, in all the realms of hypnosis, we're in deep theta, which is one of the deepest hypnosis states.
Yes, because our circumstance now as adults is like being in a hypnotic state. In other words, it's like the sense of personal self that we think, well, this is who I am. This is what I promote. This is what I protect. This is what I defend. This, you know what? This is me. And it's like the Course comes along and says, and other wisdom teachings too. It's like, oh, no, it isn't. But this picture of you is not what you are. And we associate our intellects with it, and we associate our bodies with it. And we're missing out on the big picture of what's going on, which is, and this is so foreign to so many people. Everybody has got cause and effect backwards. We think, okay, I learn to skillfully manipulate my outer world, and then I'll be happy and free. But since my outer world has no causative properties and is only a reflection, my very, very, very favorite example to talk about is your bathroom mirror. So if you go into your bathroom mirror and it kind of explain to it, I don't like that blue shirt you've got on, and I need for you to take it off. And you try to negotiate with this reflection in the mirror to take off the blue shirt, you will get nowhere, because it's merely showing you what you have on. Your world, down to the last detail, whether that's health, finances, relationships, your yard, whatever it might be, all collectively are an outpicturing of your own state of mind. Now, when your own state of mind includes feeling guilty and feeling diminished and feeling or believing those things we just discussed that kind of got wired in our very early years, then our world out here, which is just an effect, it's like a big picture, is necessarily going to look very compromised, because there's no way that I can honestly believe that at my core, I'm unworthy or undesirable, or I can't do it right, or I'm not smart enough, or whatever. It is impossible to hang on to those notions like this adequately describes me and expect a world that's going to be supportive and abundant and here for me to show up, because I'm very busy not being here for me when I believe things like that. But the deal is, and why your favorite lesson is one of my favorites as well, I'm never upset for the reason I think. I think I'm upset because the neighbor's dog barks, or I don't. In other words, we think we're upset because of something out here. Mm-hmm. We aren't. We're upset because we're terrified at a certain level that we have ruined ourselves.
And also, too, a lot of something that you, since we're talking about the outside world, how would one use the Course? Because there have been a lot of shifts on a collective level worldwide in probably the last 18 months. How would one use the Course today in dealing with all the current events that's going on?
I think you use the Course with current events the same way you do with an individual person, which is you notice, does this trigger anything in you? In other words, are you having a response to it? And if you're having any emotional response to it, first, you must deal with the emotional response. I've always said, if I could stand on the top of the Empire State Building and get people to listen to one thing, it would be, once your emotions are triggered, you must deal with them and not hide them, run to your addictions, pretend like they're not there, blame somebody else. You must accept and feel them with no story attached. And if you do that and allow the emotions to settle, if you don't, if you fight your emotions, the same chemicals that caused your upset in the first place will continue to pour into the body, because now you've told the brain, now I have another enemy. It's the chemicals in my body. So now I'm in a closed loop I can't get out of. So I must settle my emotions. And then I go, whatever is in my experience, and that's including whatever I'm seeing or hearing about or whatever, mm-hmm. I've put here. So how am I going to respond to something that is in my life because it's somehow registers with something in my own mind? And that is to realize that anybody who's behaving in an unloving way, and certainly there's been a great deal of that, they're operating from a place of fear. They're operating from a place of feeling very unsafe themselves. And if you could begin to go, it doesn't make any sense to hate people who are afraid. It makes every bit of sense to go, okay, I will follow my own guidance and my own intuition about how I'm to live my life. And if I'm to be proactive or something like that, then that I'll be guided to do it. But mostly we want to look at people whose words and behaviors we've decided aren't okay for one reason or the other and go, You know what? Those are a mirror of some of my own behaviors or fears or responses. And how would I wish to be treated if I, in my fearful state, do something unloving, so to speak? So if I can begin to see others as not such others, in other words, to recognize I'm looking at myself, my whole world is my picture. But truly, when you realize even the people who, depending upon whatever side of the political spectrum you happen to be on, or religious spectrum or anything.
That's a big trigger for a lot of people right now.
Yes, and that is, everyone is doing the highest and best of which they are capable with the mindset that they're laboring under and the beliefs that they hold about themselves. And so if we could see that what this really calls for is compassion and not censure and not blame. Now, I realize that, you know, when people commit crimes, they do have to be locked up. So I'm not saying don't follow worldly rules. I'm just talking about for our peace of mind and for our ability to be helpful to the collective, we need to keep the perspective that anybody who, shall we say, behaves badly is desperately calling for help. They are desperately calling for love. And if we offer that, that doesn't say, gee, it was a great idea to go raid the Capitol. You know, we're just saying, I do not want to hold anybody in condemnation, because with their mindset, what they believe about themselves, you know, their worldview, where they're coming from, their roots, so to speak, it makes sense. They think it's wise. They think it's the best thing to do. It's like, your sense of distress with anything just settles down to nothing when you can really get, and it's always helpful if somebody finds a time in their own life when they've been upset and to go, okay, at that time when maybe you overreacted, at that moment with whatever was coming up for you and at the emotional sense that you were feeling, you yourself did the highest and best you were capable of doing, even if that was, you know, having a tantrum or whatever it might have been. Because at the place where people are afraid, their survival seems to be at stake. And somebody who's not involved in that can look and go, no, your survival's not at stake. Well, it's not for us to decide whether they are feeling that their survival is at stake or not. In other words, this is an internal process. So the more compassion you can feel for people who are in the grip of their fear, because it's love or fear, one or the other.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Then you yourself stay calm. You do what you need to do. You keep your own mind clear so your own intuition can guide you as to what's the best contribution that I can make right now. In other words, rather than worrying about how they're not making the right contribution, I can go,
And there's a lot of that going around right now. There's a lot of that. I mean, on whatever side of the fence. And the thing is, too, is that, you know, especially because a lot of these triggers that come out with whether it's the political, the whole COVID deal that's going on, you know, there's a lot of these triggers. And if, you know, if only they would do this, if only they would do that, then I could feel safe. And a lot of us, you know, we're looking for our safety, like you just said, in this outside world, and that's not where our safety lies. And so I think that you...
Impossible. It's
impossible, especially with the world spinning as fast as it is. We're looking for stability and peace,
yes. And
it is impossible in an ego-based world. And what I love about the Course is that it's an undoing of our old stuff, our old belief system that keeps us stuck. And if we want to kind of like clear the path, in order to be in a creative mode, you can't create from a level of fear. You can't create from a level of survival.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's why it's important to allow these feelings. I love it how you said that, to allow the feeling just to come up. If you don't entertain it, if you don't give it energy, just allow it to come up and let it be. But we are taught so differently from that. We're taught not to see things from a level of free will. We're taught to react first, because if you don't react first, then you're not going to be the one upping that other person over there. One of the things that I also wanted to ask too is that why is it important to clear the clutter? Why is it important to look at these experiences, to let these experiences just flow out of our awareness, to let all of these emotions, to let all of this old baggage, why is it important to be able to face and embrace these old feelings? Why is it, you know, just to kind of like, okay, well, you know, that's over there, and why do I really need to look at it? Maybe that could be from the time that I was three, or from the time that I was conceived, or maybe even if you believe in reincarnation, lifetimes ago. Why is it important to clear that old clutter out?
Well, let's talk about the kinds of clutter we've got. We've got the first thing that happens if we find ourselves upset.
Mm-hmm.
The short-term immediate requirement is that I set aside why I think I'm upset. Now I need to begin to breathe deeply. I need to kind of scan my body to see if there's any sensations, any tightness, and it's going to show up. And the big three are the throat, the heart area, and the abdominal area.
All the chakras. Yeah, that are very important for law of attraction as well.
But those three are the ones that I hear about over and over and over again. That's where the tightness or the whatever. And it's like, okay, the first thing you do is allow that to be there. Don't try to fix anything. You just notice how you feel. And then if there is anger is a secondary emotion, and underneath it is going to be grief, hopeless, despair. All those words mean the same thing as far as I'm concerned. And the whatever they are, they need to be, it's almost like you pick up your emotions like you would pick up a little scared child and hold it on your lap, and you allow it to be there and you comfort it. And at this moment, all of your focus is on allowing your own experience to be there without trying to shunt it away or something like that. And the reason for that is, and this is very important, if I fight against how I feel, and so many people are taught to shove their emotions down, it means you're weak, it means there's something the matter with you, it means you can't do life right or whatever, all of which is nonsense. But if I do, remember, the stress response is built into the body to try to keep you alive. And so if the lion is chasing you in the jungle and wants to eat you for lunch, it's your physical body that's in jeopardy. And the stress response turns on, dumps in about 1,200 different kinds of hormones to increase your heart rate, increase your blood pressure, turn off functions of the body that aren't necessary for survival, and so on. And you either escape from the lion or you don't, but nevertheless. And the same stress response gets turned on if, for instance, suddenly you've got to speak to 1,000 people and you're scared. So now it's not your physical body, it's your sense of self feels like it's in jeopardy. So the stress response turns on and you're all upset about that. Now, when the stress response turns on, it dumps chemicals, these 1,200 or so chemicals that are taken up into all the cells of the body. And if I now decide to fight against my emotions and pretend like they aren't there and so on, I'm inadvertently and unknowingly telling my brain, hey, I have another enemy here. It's these emotions I'm feeling. Well, it can't distinguish between whether we think it's a physical enemy, a psychological, and all it knows is if I register there's a sense of threat, it keeps turning on the stress response. So now I'm in a closed loop I can't get out of. The brain's been told, help me, I'm in danger. It dumps in the chemicals, creates emotions like, oh my God, I hate these emotions. Fix it. Do something. And can you see people can be in this closed loop mm-hmm. for years and never
get out?
And the part of the problem is when the stress response is on, have you ever noticed how many ads there are for all of the stuff related to your digestive system or your excretory system or something mm-hmm. like that? Well, when your stress response is on all the time, that's one of the functions that becomes compromised. After all, we're trying to keep you alive. We need your heart rate. We need your blood. We don't need to bother about digesting food or any of that kind of stuff right now, because the body presumes, the way it's built, that this emergency is not going to last long. And then everything, all the other activities of the body can come back online. But if you spend 20, 30, 40, 70 years suppressing your emotions and thereby keeping at some level your stress response on all the time, you just wreck your body.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You also, when the stress response is on, the frontal lobe of the brain, which makes up about 40% of the brain back behind your forehead, goes offline, because the theory of your brain is if you have a survival emergency, you don't need to be thinking. So we're going to just take this thinking thing offline, which is why so many people can't think straight. They stay in a stressed state, which means they are compromised both physically, emotionally, and intellectually. So there is every reason in the world to go, well, when I'm upset, and once I let the upset settle, now I have to look and I go, what am I upset about? Well, it's what this person did, or what that, in other words, what we think we're upset about is this triggering mechanism, you know, either what the other side of the political party is doing, or what my boss is doing, or what my kids are doing, or what something out here, in which case we're not going to get anywhere because these elements are the triggers and not the cause. And if we follow this to our conclusion, which we don't have time to just do a lot of today, but we will find that all roads lead to Rome, so to speak. My Absolutely. Upset that's being triggered is really because I fear that I'm a destroyer, that I have ruined myself, that I have somehow made myself unwanted, undesirable, ineffective, no good, et cetera, et cetera.
And all that self-sabotaging talk that we give to ourselves.
Yes, the self-sabotaging talk is what I feel guilty about. There's a phrase that people quote all often that comes in the latter part of the text that talks about the tiny mad idea at which we remembered not to laugh. And the fear that we have somehow successfully ruined ourselves, and the guilt and the pain and the kind of horror that we carry about that deep in that unconscious mind, about the fear of what we have done to ourselves, is immense. And so you can't really, like you say, eat the elephant in one bite. You can't see the 9/10 of the iceberg. But our goal in life is our healing through relationships, because it's the relating with primarily people. It could be a situation, but primarily people. It's almost like, to use a visual metaphor, a little piece of the guilt iceberg, so to speak, breaks off and comes up to the surface. So, because I can only just deal with some of it, we'll call it a piece at a time. But as we learn to deal with our relationships from a very different point of view, and recognizing that everything is being sent to me for the release of my own guilt. And of course, the way that's going to happen is because if I see a behavior in somebody and I don't like it, then in fact, I'm going to tell you a real story, not a hypothetical story, with the great happy ending that comes with it. When my boys were little, let's say, I don't know, 3 and 5, 4 and 6, something like that. I lived in Denver at the time. We had there was a family next door to us on the corner, and their oldest child was our babysitter. And there was a middle child, and the youngest one was a boy. And he was about 5 or 6 years older than my older son. Well, he would climb over the fence and want to come over and play. And I didn't like this guy at all. His name was Hank. And I thought, I don't know why I don't like him. I wish he would go away. He's too hard on my kids, because he didn't deliberately try to hurt them, but they'd wrestle around on the ground, and pretty soon somebody would get hurt and somebody would start to cry and so on. And the more he was over there, the more I didn't like him. And I talked to his mother and blah, blah, blah. I'll leave out a bunch of like what I tried to do. I finally said to my husband, I'm so upset by this kid, I think we're going to have to move. And I couldn't figure out why he was not upset by him, but he wasn't. So one day, and I don't remember now if this was right at my beginning years with the court. No, it would have had to even be before. But I said to myself, what is it that I can't stand about this boy? And the thought came into my mind, he's too hard on my kids. And I go, you know what? I'm afraid I'm too hard on my kids, not by wrestling around on the floor with them, but because maybe I don't know how to do this being a mother right. Maybe I was concerned about that. The kind of the most worried part of my life was when my kids were real little, because I wasn't sure I was doing it right, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But when I said to myself, you know what? What I know is I may not be doing it right, but nobody is trying any harder to do the right thing and find out what the right thing is and learn about all of this than I am. And it, when I let myself off the hook, so to speak, so that I stopped blaming myself, I looked and I'm like, my kids appear to be in great shape. And as adults, I can tell you, they're in great shape. They're all your age or older now. In any event, but here is the magic that comes along with that. After this endless period, I mean, the whole time my kids were alive, we were next door to these people. Starting the next day, Hank stopped coming over. He just disappeared out of my life. When I really healed what he was mirroring for me, I no longer had to say, Hank, you're too old to play with the kids. He vanished. I would go sometimes for weeks or months and never lay eyes on him because we had a 6-foot fence between the yard. They were on the corner, so their driveway went out to that street instead of the one in the front of the houses. And all of the animosity vanished when I realized he is just showing me what I am doing to myself. So I can stop doing this to myself. That kind of a mirror no longer needs to be in my life. I, of all of my attempts to make him go away, were impossible because of what was still going on with me. But when I cleared up this piece of guilt, the mirror vanished. And later on, when his sister went off to college, and our kids were right at that age where in a few circumstances, they weren't quite old enough to leave alone, depending on whatever, I'd have him come over and babysit.
Oh, wow. Talk about the tides have changed.
And this is a predictable happening 100% of the time.
I totally agree with you. I know that when I do the lessons that it will show me everything that I have that is in my subconscious belief system that is opposite of what it says. And it shows me, and I look at it as a level of clearing. Okay, well, it's stuff I've got to look at. It's stuff that has to come through. So because I want to have a life of what my true nature is, and that's, you know, peace.
Absolutely.
And joy and abundance. And one of the things that I also wanted to talk about too was that when we are looking at, you know, that, you know, this life that we want to have and clearing all of that, this is really a kind of like a death of this false sense of self, because as we start to do this work and as we start to basically kind of take the trigger, the ignition off of this stagnant energy, this past energy, this learned energy, this false sense of self energy, it really starts to get to a point where again, we can do law of attraction and we can give ourselves those feelings and it starts coming to us a little faster. And then also too, just kind of like this clearing where life just works through us. And it really kind of leads us into this level of life that's just like, wow, I can't believe it. It's just so amazing. It's just, I couldn't have even thought of anything better. And I think that
is just really, really, really important to realize that it points always to how my inner life and my outer life are one life. But I think it might frighten people to talk about the death of the ego, because that would be like the death of your storybook of Little Red Riding Hood. In other words, it's like it's not so much that it's die. And the reason why is if we honest to God think I am this body personality, what? We want it to die? It's like, it's very hard to get people to sign up for that. But yeah. If I can go, you know what? I just carry a little story around with me. And I remember when our kids were little, you could have these tailor-made books with their names and the names of the neighbor kids. And they would, whatever the story was, they would weave them into it. So it's kind of like we start out reading from the story of me book. We're creating it as we go along from that early 3 years experience kind of thing. And at some point we go, this is not a very interesting story. In other words, when I find that there's a much better way to live, it's not that it dies, it's that I put it in proper perspective. I realize, yes, there's a body, yes, there's a personality, but now, how am I going to use what we might call are those assets, in other words? And that is, I am turning them over to the highest good. I'm turning them over. I'm going to let my intuition guide the way rather than the self-serving notions of the ego, which is it's always about its own defense and survival. So I'm going to go, yeah, I hear you, but you sit over here right now. And my prayer, my goal is going to be, I'm here to listen. I'm here to be truly helpful. And whether you call it guidance or whatever you want to call it, or you can call it the Holy Spirit, that's a religious term for your guidance or your intuition. And when you allow your life more and more and more to be led by this real wisdom instead of the things that I've learned at an intellectual level, then you don't hate your body. You don't hate your physical world. You don't try to push it away like an aesthetic who's ascetic. I can never say that word, living in the jungle, you know, with sackcloth and ashes. In other words, none of that is called for. It's a repositioning of what's important. And what's important is at any moment of any day, I'm either operating out of my ego mind, which is never going to have a happy ending, or I'm allowing my guidance, my intuition, my hunches, the things that people may say. It's like I begin to listen, like what's going on in my own mind. And I can't imagine now living any other way than the way I get messages. They'll be like ticker tape across for the stock market or something. It's like all of a sudden it's like, do this or call this person or
absolutely whatever. Yeah, and it's that intuition,
it's right there for everyone if you make that your priority. So guess what? Every single moment is a brand new clean moment. The past is not stored anywhere. It doesn't exist anymore. It's not like a library where you pull down a book and there's the same reliable story in it. It's not so. And so you go, this moment is the moment of power. This is the moment. Cause and effect is in this moment. It's not a horizontal line with I'm experiencing now because of what happened back then. Nope. I'm experiencing now what I believe this minute, what the state of my mind is this minute. And I can change that. Nothing and nobody keeps me from saying, it doesn't matter what's happened up to this moment. At this moment, it is my prayer, it's my desire to be all that I can be in service to the growing and the enlightening and so on of everything and everybody. In other words, to bring love into the world in action.
Absolutely. And we don't have to do it alone. We can do it with the just a simple ask for guidance through, like you said, whether you call it Holy Spirit, you can call it your angels, you can call it your highest self. But that part which is never left, which is connected to who we truly are, independent of this false sense of self. And we have, and with that, we go from our little old way of doing things, from an old programmed way of doing things that obviously didn't work in the past, to infinite potential, to infinite possibilities.
Absolutely. I mean, you are the wielder of power that we can't even imagine. It's responsible for whatever all the details are in your world. And the thing that cripples us is guilt, because guilt is always a request for punishment, whether you know it or not. And you will always get it. It's not like on your computer, if you start to do something and a little data box comes up and it says, you know, are you sure you want to delete this or something like that? The universe doesn't say, are you really sure you want to be praying for all this punishment? It just kind of is, your wish is my command.
Absolutely.
You're a sovereign presence. And so if you're going to indulge in fear and hatred and trying to export your guilt out there rather than what I can do now. And the reason why healing through relationships is so important, I can look at a somebody out here that I've been busy condemning or thinking or doing the wrong thing or whatever, and I can go, that would not be in my life if it were not a mirror of something that I fear about myself. And so how am I going to handle that? I'm going to handle that by wanting for this person or group of people or family member or whoever it may be, I want for them only to feel loved and safe and recognize they're always doing the best they can, that they are still a loving presence. And when I really genuinely want to send a kind of sense of goodwill toward them, then I am engaging one of the most important processes there is, that what I offer to others, I have more of. So the more compassion, the more love, the more understanding, the more willingness to explore and so on that I really want for you so that your life can be better, I am the primary recipient of that, because the thoughts are in my mind. The thoughts of goodwill and understanding toward a so-called somebody else. But everybody wins. I feel better and better and better. And of course, I've offered them in my own way release. And there's no other way to do this. It's not like, is there some other way? It's like, no, there's not any other way.
It's what you give out there is what you receive back. So what you give out is what you receive. It's kind of like, what was that old saying? Be the change that you want to see in the world.
Yeah,
well, thank you so much, Carol. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show today. And thank you. I've always loved the Course in Miracles, and I really thank you. Just such an honor to have you on today.
Oh, well, it's been my pleasure. After 44 years, I still think it's more fun to talk about than anything.
The book is like Christmas morning. Every time I open it up and I start to read it, it's like it's just new all over again. I don't know how that happens, but it's wonderful. Thank you again, Carol.
You're sure welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Infinite Success with Elena Scher. She will be back next week with another great show.